court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I'll call our second case of the day, Wren versus Richardson. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel? Please do.
May it please the court, petitioner Joshua Wren is appearing by attorney John Boschalewski. Joshua Wren was also the petitioner in the habeas petition, which was addressed by the Court of Appeals, which brings us here today. Joshua Wren was convicted in a criminal matter that arose when he was 15 in 2005. His conviction was in 2006. He wanted to appeal. He told his attorney to appeal. The fact-finding court found this. The fact-finding court also found that the trial counsel had assured not only Mr. Wren, but three of his family members immediately after the sentencing, don't worry, I'll file an appeal, and that never happened. In 2010 or 11, again, a finding of the fact-finding court was that Mr. Wren finally realized after writing to his attorney and getting no response, after his family members tried to reach the attorney without any response, there was no appeal. And he floundered, and he filed some things that were not this habeas petition, collateral petitions. And he did this with the help of other inmates. And finally...
How old was he at that time? So he was 16 when he was convicted?
He was 16 when he was convicted in 2006. So born
about
in 1990.
20 years old.
Yes. So he made some what might be characterized as misdirected efforts, and by that I mean they weren't directed to reinstating his direct appeal rights. Finally, though, he testified he corresponded with an uncle who was an inmate in another institution and was put on the path towards seeking reinstatement of his appeal rights. Judge Stark, the fact-finding judge, found that even when he realized there was no appeal, he wanted to appeal, but he didn't know how to go about it.
Would it have been unreasonable to expect him to write a simple letter to a court in very plain English saying, I wanted to appeal, I told my attorney to file an appeal, and he didn't. Can I get some help?
If he knew that that's what would trigger reinstatement of his appeal rights, yes, but he had missed the deadline. And in fact, what I believe the Court of Appeals quoted his collateral proceedings and the response of the court, and one of the responses was, well, the time for direct appeal has long since passed. It only reinforced his sense that a direct appeal was not an option or not a possibility.
Well, he filed a number of pro se motions, but I don't think in any of those motions he mentioned, I wanted to appeal and my attorney didn't file what was necessary.
No.
So is it unreasonable to expect him to have just thrown that into one of his pro se filings or, like I said, just write a letter? Even if it didn't comply with the rules, even if it was a little late, just something letting a court know that his attorney dropped the ball.
In hindsight, if he were my client, I'd certainly advise him to do that. He didn't have a lawyer to tell him how to direct his efforts. He went with the assistance he got, the non-lawyer assistance he got in the prison. He filed a cherry motion addressing the DNA surcharge and a reconsideration motion of that. He did it piecemeal because he didn't know he could.
Does his age matter? Should we have less expectations for somebody who's a young adult, teenager, versus somebody who's in his 30s or 40s?
Well, it certainly matters. He was a very young defendant. It also, I think, affected the Judge Stark's, fact-finding proceedings, that she took that into account, that he had limitations. He was very young. In fact, the pre-sentence report, which is in the record, reflects he has a second-grade reading level. That before he was sentenced, he went for the pre-sentence interview and was tested and had a second grade reading level. So he has limitations, and I certainly think those have to factor in. You might view this case very differently if Mr. Wren had a law degree or if he had a higher level of education. But even then, it's not necessarily self-evident that once a deadline is passed, it can be reinstated. It's self-evident to we who practice the law every day, but it's not necessarily to an uneducated young criminal defendant.
Does it play into your argument as well that it was unclear even how you go about doing that when it was, I believe, 2014 when it was determined where you would actually file such a motion to reinstate direct appeal, correct?
I believe he filed his habeas petition to reinstate the appeal in 2017. I could be mistaken on the exact date.
Right, but I'm saying in terms of doing it earlier.
Yes.
It would have been unclear how he was supposed to proceed. Go to the circuit court, go to the court of appeals. Does that play into your argument as well?
Well, yes. This all, of course, comes down to the fact that because his trial counsel dropped the ball, he didn't have counsel. He didn't have the counsel that he was constitutionally entitled to. He might have gone forever without figuring out that he could ask to reinstate his direct appeal rights, but as he testified, he communicated with an incarcerated uncle who steered him the right way. And
how many months after that communication did he file?
I believe it was 3 to 4 months, he stated. So the state is seeking to deny Mr. Wren reinstatement of his direct appeal by arguing that latches should prevent that relief. And it's my contention it should not, basically for two reasons. The second one, which I addressed primarily in my petition for review, is that I don't think the elements were proved. I don't think the equities favor applying it. I also argued, though, that latches should not apply in habeas proceedings absent a rule that authorizes it.
Counsel, we just addressed this issue again just a few months ago in the Lopez decision. Are you asking us to reconsider something that we just looked at? I mean, we just said in that opinion the application of latches to bar habeas petitions is well established.
That is stated in the opinion. And I researched how it came to be established and realized this court has never actually addressed whether it's a good idea or a bad idea or a proper or improper thing to apply latches in the first instance.
You are asking us to reconsider Lopez Quintero.
I am asking this court to reconsider whether latches should apply in a habeas proceeding, yes. And I believe that.
And that would require us to, if we agreed with you that it doesn't, that would require us to overrule Lopez Quintero from last term.
To the extent that it states that latches is a defense in a habeas case, it would. And the reason I argued that, Judge, Your Honor, is because of the roots of the concept and how it all comes with the McMillian case. That's the very first Wisconsin case that suggested you could apply latches as a defense to a habeas petition. And that case cites to federal cases that in turn cite to a federal rule. And
are you suggesting that there is no limitation whatsoever on the ability to bring a habeas petition?
Well, I'm suggesting that latches is not one of those defenses.
So is it your position that a defendant could, let's say, sentenced to 30 years, wait for 10 years for the file to be destroyed, and then ask for reinstatement of his direct appeal rights, knowing that there is no transcript and the argument from the case we just heard this morning would result in an automatic new trial? Is there anything that would prohibit that from happening?
Well, it would depend on the... I guess there wouldn't be, Your Honor, but...
Counsel, can I take you back to the facts of this case?
Certainly.
Would you tell us why we shouldn't just apply the Washington case, and this is just like Washington, and this delay was unreasonable, and therefore he should not be able to proceed?
Well, I disagree that this case is just like Washington.
Why?
First of all, in Washington, the court found that Mr. Washington was relatively sophisticated. I believe they used the phrase, he's not a novice. He filed a number of collateral challenges to his aspects of his conviction, and there's no evidence he needed any help to do that, unlike Mr. Wren. And he filed the motion that became at issue in the Washington case when he was near the end of his sentence, but after he found out he was going to be facing a 980 petition to be incarcerated as a sexually dangerous person.
Isn't it also significant that Washington had the benefit of post-conviction counsel?
That's another distinction. He did have post-conviction counsel. He did have a post-conviction motion, that motion was denied, and there was a factual dispute about whether he wanted to appeal that. He claims he did. His lawyer claims he agreed to drop it, and his lawyer, while he didn't have a file, I think had letters that verified that from his part of the correspondence, it was agreed to drop that. So I think that case was easy enough to decide simply on the notion there was no factual basis for Mr. Washington's claim that he always wanted to appeal the denial of his post-conviction motion. But back to the point you raised, he did have post-conviction counsel. He was never left stranded like Mr. Wren, where his trial counsel left the sentencing hearing promising an appeal that never happened. Mr. Washington had post-conviction counsel. He got into a dispute with that post-conviction counsel, but he wasn't left hanging as Mr. Wren was. So that, I think, makes Washington very different. And the Court of Appeals, in the decision in this case, acknowledges these differences and simply maintains they're not persuaded nonetheless, without really explaining why.
Well, they seem to give a lot of weight to the pro se motions he did file. So what's your response to that?
Well, he filed them with help. And, in fact, I don't recall which one off the top of my head, but one of them you can tell was drafted by someone else because his name under the signature line is misspelled. Not something someone would do normally when drafting one's own motion. Again, these were misdirected efforts, at least in terms of why we're here today. They didn't seek reinstatement of a direct appeal. But as this court noted in Coleman, had he done nothing for the whole 11 years from the date he was sentenced to the date he filed the petition before the court today, well, in Coleman, that was suggested to weigh unfavorably when considering whether the delay was unreasonable. Mr. Wren was trying to do something. He wasn't doing the right thing because he was unsophisticated and because he was denied the right to counsel that could have steered him right or represented him in going down the right path. But he did want relief from his conviction and sentence, and his attempts to file pro se filings show that.
He pled guilty, right?
He did.
And he wanted to challenge his sentence on appeal.
The reason he gave for appealing was he was dissatisfied with the sentence. The people at the fact-finding hearing said 13 years was what they were led to expect. That was the recommendation in the pre-sentence report. Defense counsel asked for 5 to 6 years of initial confinement. Instead, he got 21.
Is the sentencing transcript in the record?
It is.
Counsel, this is an unpublished per curiam opinion of the Court of Appeals, and often we find those opinions to be rather succinct, short. And the analysis engaged in with regard to the three elements of latches was set forth. And then the methodology, after going through the three elements, and if they are shown, the next step is to weigh the equities. And to my read, the Court of Appeals opinion did that in one paragraph. How would you weigh the equities in this instance?
Well, in the first instance, and I know this was a matter of some dispute in the briefing about whether it's putting the cart before the horse to even talk about the denial of counsel when the issue is latches, but they're really inseparable. This whole thing started when Mr. Wren's court-appointed counsel dropped the ball and didn't file an appeal. And as a result, Mr. Wren got neither the appeal he desired nor the counsel to which he was entitled for that appeal.
Counsel, let me be more succinct. I mean, as I recall in reading that opinion, I hope I recall correctly, there was prejudice to the state. Then there's the argument advanced in your brief, but there's prejudice to the defendant. So give me this weighing and balancing of why one should outweigh the other, which is part of the formula for determining whether latches an equitable remedy with the exercise of discretion should be applied.
Well, as a matter of equity, the failings of trial counsel to initiate the appeal are attributable to the state. And that's under that Coleman versus Thompson case. So the state failed Mr. Wren in giving him his right to appeal and his right to counsel on appeal by virtue of his appointed counsel's failings. And now they are saying, well, sure, he was left without counsel for 10 or 11 years till he finally filed this petition, but, you know, now, because of that 10 or 11 years, that's all Mr. Wren's fault. Well, in the first instance, it's not. And in the second instance, where they want to say, well, maybe he should have done something, well, he did do something. He didn't do the right thing. He filed collateral motions, but he didn't know. And this is a finding of fact by the fact-finding court. He didn't know how to appeal. His means and his intellect were limited. And so the equities simply don't favor the state because at the root, they're the ones who, they're not they, but the state is imputed to be responsible for him not having filed an appeal.
Well, counsel, I mean, the first element of latches, unreasonable delay. I understand you prefer it not, you know, exist here, but this court, you know, has held that. That presumes that there's a responsibility even outside of counsel to assert your rights, doesn't it?
Assert your rights to the extent you know them. But you can't separate reasonableness from the facts here. The facts are, and
what should we reasonably expect from a pro se person in the situation here of Mr. Wren? What is reasonable for courts to expect when applying the latches analysis?
Well, I think it's very heavily fact-based, and that's why I rely very heavily on the findings of fact here. Mr. Wren, for several years, didn't even know that he didn't have an appeal in progress. He was looking to trial counsel for that, and there's a letter in the record that he wrote to trial counsel, not saying, did you file an appeal, but how's my appeal going? He thought he had an appeal, and he's under this misimpression or misconception for till 2010 or 2011. That's what the fact-finding court found. After that point, he did what he could to challenge aspects of his conviction and sentence. He did it with the help of non-lawyers in the prison, and got very little in the form of relief doing that. And then finally, it's difficult to say he sat on rights he didn't know he had.
Can you give me an example of the type of knowledge that you think would be sufficient for him, for us to hold him to, or for a court applying this analysis to hold him to?
Well, I think...
Where it would cross the line of being an unreasonable delay?
Well, I think a basic level of literacy would be a verse requirement to hold a defendant to that level, although I don't think by itself that's necessarily enough either. Duren lacked even that, as I pointed out earlier.
Is the finding of the circuit court that he did not know how to do so, let me put that in context. The finding of the circuit court is sometime in 2010 or 2011, Wren concluded that Attorney Kostich had not filed an appeal on his behalf. After reaching this conclusion, Wren still wanted to seek post-conviction relief regarding ineffective assistance of trial counsel and the sentence, but he did not know how to do so. Is there any argument or basis to assert that these findings are clearly erroneous?
No such claim has been made, and I'm not making that claim. I believe it supports Mr. Wren's position that he wanted to appeal, he just didn't know how to go about it. And again, it leads back to his state-appointed trial counsel dropping the ball and not starting the appeal as he requested. If there are no questions, I guess I'd like to address another element of Latches that we really haven't much discussed, which is the prejudice to the state aspect. The only thing this comes down to is Mr. Kostich was not available to testify as to his side of events. But I really am at a loss to understand what the state hoped to obtain from Mr. Kostich if he were alive to testify. There could really hardly be a dispute that no appeal was filed. That's a matter of record. Four witnesses testified that Mr. Kostich said, "Don't worry, I'll file an appeal." I suppose the only thing the state could hope for is that if Mr. Kostich were alive, he'd take issue with that and say Mr. Wren didn't want an appeal, but the record shows he did. The state does have a remedy to someone just coming forward on their own and saying, "My lawyer didn't give me the appeal I asked for," and that's the Lukasik case I cited in my reply brief that requires that when an attorney dies and you want to claim ineffective assistance from that attorney, a defendant can't just, based on the defendant's own word and claim, get relief under an ineffective assistance theory unless the claim is corroborated. In this case, it is corroborated by three other witnesses. So I think the prejudice in this case, it's hard to see what Mr. Kostich could have done to change it. And in most cases, the state's protected by the corroboration rule from unwarranted claims of prejudice. So I don't believe the state has established prejudice. And for that reason alone, this court should not apply latches.
Well, some that the state has shown prejudice, assume that. Then what kind of prejudice has the defendant encountered, if any, to weigh against that?
Well, Mr. Wren has been incarcerated for 11 years without an appeal. Again, because his state-appointed counsel didn't initiate that appeal. So that's the whole basis of the habeas petition is, you know, what's wrong with this? What habeas is based on the notion of unlawful or unconstitutional detention. And here, the detention is detention that was done without granting Mr. Wren his right to appellate review. So he's gone 11 years. That's the prejudice he's suffered by virtue of conduct that's attributable to the state by his appointed trial counsel.
Thank you.
I see my time is up.
Good morning. Assistant Attorney General Sarah Schaefer representing the respondent. The state is asking this court to affirm the Court of Appeals' decision that denied Mr. Wren's petition for writ of habeas corpus under the doctrine of latches. It is the state's position that it has proved the only two elements of latches at issue today, unreasonable delay and prejudice, and it is also the state's position that the Court of Appeals reasonably exercised its discretion when it balanced the equities and determined that equities favors the application of latches in this case.
Counsel, with respect to the prejudice prong of latches, to what is that applicable? Is it to your ability to respond to the writ petition, or is it your ability to prosecute the case on a new trial?
As this court stated in Lopez-Quintero, the prejudice goes to any prejudice that the state has experienced as a result of the unreasonable delay. With respect to
counsel, as I understand it, the habeas petition, which I again just looked at, the relief that's being requested is the his right to pursue post-conviction motions and a direct appeal. So vis-a-vis the relief that's requested, that is, let me have an appeal, what kind of prejudice does the state have?
The state is prejudiced basically because it does not have an opportunity to really to respond to his claim of ineffective counsel, which is why he's saying he should have his direct appeal rights reinstated. The state was prejudiced because it could not call Mr. Kostich to the evidentiary hearing. His file was lost.
Okay, let's take ineffective assistance of counsel and set that aside. I don't know what else might be the basis of his direct appeal. Would you be prejudiced with any other issue?
Like if he...
Was there a suppression motion here at all or anything?
No.
So the only issue that exists or could exist on direct appeal, the state is opining, is what?
Well, we don't know that because at the evidentiary hearing, that question was posed to Mr. Wren by both the state and by counsel. And we said, well, would you appeal the sentence? And they said, well, yes. And then he said, well, if you had an attorney, the attorney would help you with the decision on what to appeal. And he said, yes. So there's been no pinpoint as to what his issue.
That's why I'm trying to grapple with this. What they want is a direct appeal. Without knowing for sure what the issue on direct appeal is going to be, how do you know that you're going to be prejudiced in responding to that issue. Here there's a transcript, right?
Right.
Of whatever might exist. It wasn't a trial. It was a plea, of course, but right. Other hearings. So.
Well, the prejudice aspect of latches only just goes to how was the state prejudiced as to the unreasonable delay of the petitioner in bringing his claim. It doesn't really look at to the how the state would be prejudiced if it was if this court were to grant the direct appeal rights, how would it say it's...
So you're not asserting that if this court would reinstate his appeal rights, you're not asserting prejudice vis-a-vis that?
I am not right now. The only thing I am asserting for prejudice is that his unreasonable delay prejudiced the state in responding to his ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
And let's just be clear, that's because his attorney passed away, which he has no fault of his own either. So the prejudice could easily be attributable to him as well, right?
The prejudice that the state is advancing in this case is that, sure, his attorney passed in 2014, and that's no fault to his own, but he knew in 2010 or 2011 that his direct appeal rights had expired, and he did nothing about it. Had he, by 2010 or 2011, made an effort, wrote a letter, as Justice Bradley, wrote a letter to a court, said, hey, my direct appeal rights, have expired. I would like to basically fix that. We would have had Kostich still alive. We probably could have had his files. The state would have been in a position then to counter his claim of ineffective.
Well, you're making some assumptions, right? I mean, Mr.
Sure.
Kostich was also brought up on a lot of ineffective claims in the past, and for all you know, by the time of 2011 or 2010, Mr. Kostich might have had no memory at all. It might have had the same thing that we had here, which was a checked, right, a box that was checked days before, and you're going to rely on the fact that he then would have known exactly what his client said to him?
Right, and that's counsel makes the points. We don't know. We can only offer conjecture about what would happen because he unreasonably delayed in bringing this habeas petition.
And let me ask you this. If we did go back to 2010 or 2011 and Mr. Kostich testified that he didn't know, wouldn't it then that he didn't know? And then you heard the court heard all this testimony from the defendant that he tried, that he wanted to appeal and that his family had tried and whatever else was put forward. The trial counsel would then have to make a decision, right? And that decision, to say the state was somehow prejudiced by all this, you're really speculating. Because given that record, the trial court would probably say, yeah, it sounds like there's enough here for the defendant to get his right to appeal.
I mean, I agree that the state is speculating. And that is bringing me back to the point is that's the only thing we can do because we don't have him here, because we don't have his files. We can only speculate at what would happen. And so the state can't really address the deficiency prong because we don't know counsel's version of events.
And you're saying that it is the deficiency in not being able to pursue this habeas? I know Justice Bradley asked this question, but I was under the impression as well that really the prejudice would be the state's ability to continue to prosecute him, which at this point you've got a plea. So the only thing he could challenge is the plea and the sentencing, which we have transcripts for. So where's isn't that what the prejudice prong is supposed to go to?
The prejudice prong, as this court said in Lopez-Quintero, goes to the state's ability to respond and latches to the unreasonable delay. And the unreasonable delay here is because we don't have these files, because we don't have the notes, because we don't have counsel's testimony. What did he tell Mr. Wren? What happened after sentencing?
Could I just stop you right there? Because I want to make sure that we're tracking with the circuit court findings of fact. Because you're not challenging the circuit court's findings of fact, correct?
No, I'm not challenging.
Okay. So the circuit court found, as a matter of fact, that Wren told his counsel he was dissatisfied with the sentence. The counsel told him not to worry because he would appeal, and that Wren therefore believed an appeal would be filed, right?
Correct.
And then the circuit court also found that Wren did not have any personal contact with Attorney Kostich after the sentencing hearing. Wren did not attempt to have any personal contact with Attorney Kostich after he left the courtroom at the conclusion of the sentencing hearing and before the expiration of the 20-day deadline set forth in the statutes. So what would the availability of Mr. Kostich possibly tell you that is relevant to the inquiry about whether he was prejudiced by his counsel's failure to pursue post-conviction relief?
Because we don't have testimony from Mr. Koch's or his file about what happened after sentencing, assuming the findings are true that there was no communication. We don't know from Mr. Koch's, did you try to attempt to contact these people? Was there any conversation that you had with Mr. Wren after sentencing?
The circuit court said there was no contact between Wren and Costage prior to the expiration of the deadline.
No. Right.
That's a fact. We take that as a given. All right. So now we get Mr. Costage and somehow we figure out how to get through to him and ask him some questions. And we say, well, Mr. Costage, what happened after the expiration of the deadline? Well, who cares? Right? It's just about what happened prior to that.
Right, and we need to know what happened during that deadline, between sentencing.
Well, we know nothing happened. We know there was no contact between Costage and Wren. We know that there was no contact between them after he left the sentencing hearing. We know that Wren did want an appeal, and his attorney told him there would be an appeal, and he therefore believed there would be an appeal. What else do we need to know?
Because this is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and he has to prove deficient performance, we need to talk to the attorney and see what is it. The attorney needs to address these claims, needs to address this claim, and the attorney is not here at the evidentiary hearing to address this claim.
Okay. So tell me, what could he potentially say that does not contradict these findings of fact?
He could say, I tried to contact Mr. Wren. I tried to contact him. And he could say, we did have a conversation. He could refute.
That would be contrary to the facts.
Right. But here's the thing about the findings of fact. The state could not claim that they were clearly erroneous because we had nothing to provide at the hearing.
Okay. So what you're saying is that you are prejudiced in that you cannot check the correctness of the found facts.
That's one way that we are prejudiced, is we had no way to do it. We didn't have any files. We didn't have a record. We didn't have Mr. Koch's. We were hindered as Lopez Quintero said, in our ability to prove prejudice because of this unreasonable delay. So because of his unreasonable delay in bringing his habeas claim, we were prejudiced even at the evidentiary hearing to bring Mr. Koch's available to challenge these findings because we didn't have anything.
I haven't seen in the briefs this argument that you are making now, that you're prejudiced because you are not able to show that the findings were clearly erroneous. I focus on this finding. The finding that Attorney Costage intentionally, and I emphasize the word, intentionally led Wren and third parties acting on his behalf to believe that he would timely complete the requirements necessary for the defendant to seek post-conviction relief, and then he failed to do so without notifying Wren or third parties acting on his behalf. In this court or below, have you ever advanced that this finding is clearly erroneous?
No, Your Honor.
Can we move to the other piece of this, the unreasonable delay? When you're looking at unreasonable delay, or actually when the court looks at unreasonable delay, do you think that things like age of the individual, reading level, sophistication, do you think that those should play a part in the court's analysis?
I think that when you're considering latches, that it is very case specific. And in this instance, when he became aware that his direct appeal rights had expired, he was in his 20s. I think it should be something the court can look at. As I said, it is a very case specific analysis. But in this case, he knew in 2010 or 2011 that his direct appeal rights had expired, and he didn't notify any court about that.
And so your expectation would be that individuals in prison who are pro se, who've been there since the age of 16, should know how to challenge something that they believe has already passed?
No, again, it is case specific, but in this, even if he didn't know that he had to file a night petition in the Court of Appeals, he could have reached out, he could have wrote a letter, he didn't try to do anything, and he did avail himself to the courts in the past. He knew that he could reach to the courts and they would actually, you know, respond with an answer. In this case, he knew his direct appeal rights had expired and he didn't do anything about that.
Okay, but when you say he didn't do anything about it, you're making the assumption that individuals who aren't lawyers, who are 16 at a reading level of second grade in prison, should know that when a right has expired that they actually have an ability to try to reinstate that right and then should know how to go about doing that.
No, I'm saying when he became aware when he was 20 and he wasn't 16, and while the PSI, there's no evidence, there's no findings that he still had a second grade reading level at the time of the evidentiary hearing or when he...
And there's no findings otherwise?
Correct. Correct. I'm saying that when he's an adult and he's 20 and he's been filing all these collateral motions, he knows how to file motions. He knows that he can ask the court, hey, my direct appeal rights have expired, you know, can you help me? He didn't do anything. He didn't write a letter. He didn't file a motion.
And why would he, and you're just making the assumption that he would know that he could challenge a right that had already expired?
Even if he didn't know the right vehicle or the right court, the evidence shows he didn't do anything about it.
Well, counsel, here's another finding. The finding is lack of knowledge. It is Wren still wanted to seek post-conviction relief regarding ineffective assistance of trial counsel and the sentence, but he did not know how to do so.
Correct.
Isn't holding him to writing a letter or suggesting he should know enough to do that contrary to that finding?
I'm sorry, could you, I guess I don't understand.
Understand you to be holding him to at least the level of, hey, he may not know much, but he should know enough if he wants some kind of post-conviction relief, that he should write a letter to the court. But here we have a specific finding that he wanted those things but didn't know how to do so.
But there's also no finding that he was prohibited from learning how to do so. There's no finding that he lacked resources. So it stops there. And the next finding is that even with this knowledge, with the assistance of other people, he filed motions in 2010, 2011, 2013, 2016 before filing.
Is knowledge the touchstone here? Isn't that implicated in the reasonableness of his actions?
The unreasonable delay?
Yes.
Of Latches?
I mean, the court made a finding.
Sure.
He didn't know, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, and if I'm unfairly paraphrasing, let me know because I don't want to. But the court's finding is essentially he still wanted relief, but he didn't know how to go about it.
Sure. And the Court of Appeals addressed this, I thought, very well, and they compared it to the Washington case, where the Washington petitioner kind of made the same argument. He said, you know, I'm proving that I want some form of relief because I'm filing these collateral motions. Well, but you knew, as the Washington court said, you knew 6 years ago that your direct appeal rights had expired and you did nothing. And so the Court of Appeals, I think, was correct on relying heavily, as he said in the opinion, on the Washington case, where it was 6 years and he knew and he waited and he did nothing to advance his direct appeal rights.
As I recall Washington, he knew and then there was a specific, did he already tell his attorney to do it and then he told his attorney not to do it specifically? There was some concern about Washington gaming the system, quote, lying in the weeds, unquote.
Oh, laying in the weeds. I remember Washington, there was, as you said, there was a post-conviction, the attorney represented him in the post-conviction hearing, and then their understanding was, well, the attorney testified that I was just supposed to do the motion, I wasn't supposed to do the appeal, and then there was evidence in Washington that the attorney wrote letters to the defendants and said, your direct appeal rights basically expired in 2003. And so basically the court had that as well. to substantiate his claim that, you know, the claim was that he was unreasonable in bringing his habeas petition.
Does the fact that Mr. Washington had post-conviction counsel play into your argument here where Mr. Wren had none?
I don't think so, because they're both claiming that they were denied the right to a direct appeal, and that was their same claim.
So you see no distinction between someone who actually had an attorney and could have reviewed the case and gone forward versus the person whose attorney dropped the ball?
Well, we don't know if the state is not conceding that Mr. Koch just dropped the ball in this case. With regard to the first issue that Mr. Wren raises on appeal, it's the state's position that this court held a few months ago that latches does apply to habeas proceedings, and that this court should continue to hold that, and that there's no need to overrule Lopez-Quintero. Briefly, with respect to his argument that Lukasik basically... the state is protected from baseless ineffective assistance of counsel claims because a Lukasik provides that there must be corroboration. But Lukasik also provides the type of corroboration that is needed, and that, assuming the attorney is deceased, and it said such evidence could be letters from the attorney to the client, transcripts made by the attorney, or other tangible evidence which would show the attorney's ineffective representation. So I disagree that he has shown corroborating evidence in this case.
What about that letter that was, I thought, maybe attached to his habeas? At any rate, the letter that a couple of years after his sentencing inquires as to, hey, how's my appeal going?
Right.
Isn't that some kind of corroborating evidence that he was under the impression that his request for an appeal was being honored?
I don't, under Lukasik, no, that would not constitute corroborating evidence because it's not a letter from the attorney to the client or a statement made from.
And so it's just from the client to the attorney.
Right. It's just, and Lukasik says his words are not enough.
Counsel, in the trial court findings, the trial court said no evidence was received regarding any effort on the attorney's part to seek an extension or why he didn't do so or anything like that, and because he passed away, obviously. What are we to make of that caveat before the trial court goes on to make a bunch of findings after that?
So I think the reason the trial court made that is because when the Court of Appeals initially remanded it for an evidentiary hearing, it gave 9 things that it wanted the trial court to consider, and one was specifically that claim, that issue is whether it's whether, although the Court of Appeals records do not so reflect, Attorney Kostich sought to extend the deadline for filing the notice of intent, and if not, why not? So I think basically she was just addressing the Court of Appeals that, it wanted this information, and
sure,
it couldn't give the Court of Appeals this information because Attorney Kostich is deceased and his files could not be located.
Did that also indicate checking the Court of Appeals files? Sometimes there's correspondence with the clerk's office and things like that. I just don't know the answer. I mean, there could be evidence in the clerk's file. I want to file an appeal, or I filed an appeal, but you got it in too late. You're supposed to file it by 5, and you filed it late at night. That's a problem sometimes, isn't it, Justice?
I'm the 5 o'clock.
Do you know, was there any review of the Court of Appeals file or correspondence with the clerk? I don't know that. I just asked.
I do know that. And perhaps co-counsel can answer this better, but he did hire an investigator to find Mr. Wren's file, and he did talk to the state bar, and I know he did talk to his prior law partner and family members as well, and we could not find, but I don't know if he corresponded with the court of appeals. there are no other questions, I don't have anything further.
Thank you.
Regarding the file of Mr. Kostich, I did have my investigator attempt to locate it, and that investigator prepared a memorandum which the district attorney and I stipulated to, and it's introduced as an exhibit in the fact-finding hearing. But my investigator was unsuccessful in obtaining any file or finding that any file existed regarding Mr. Kostich's representation of Mr. Wren. Ms. Schaefer, when addressing the prejudice issue, I guess initially seemed to say prejudice could be any prejudice, and then as I understood her, she backed away and said, well, no, it's really only prejudice to defend against the habeas action asking for reinstatement of appeal rights. And if, I think that second position is the correct one, that prejudice is only relevant to the degree the state was prejudiced in defending the petition before the court, the habeas petition, and before the fact-finding court. And I addressed earlier how it's hard to conceive what Mr. Kostich could have said that would have negated the, I think, overwhelming inference from the findings of fact that Mr. Kostich performed efficiently in not initiating an appeal.
Counsel, I want to make sure that when we write the rule in this case, that we don't go places we shouldn't. It sounded to me that you were saying that the prejudice in the third prong of the Latches analysis applies only with respect to the ability to defend against the writ petition, not the underlying sentence or conviction. Is that correct?
That's correct. And okay. At this point, we don't even know what those claims would be. I mean, transcripts haven't been requested, and the only ones on file are the sentencing and, I believe, the prelim.
So let me suggest a potential scenario. Perhaps a direct appeal from the conviction has not been made, same kind of situation here. And now it's 10 years post-conviction. The transcripts are all destroyed. Would the state not be able to use that fact as an element of Latches to say, well, look, if the writ's granted, we have no ability to go back and do this trial again. We don't, witnesses are gone, their memories are faded, there's no way to do a new trial if that, if the person were successfully to get their direct appeal back and have it reversed. State can't say any of that?
Well, this is a plea case.
I understand. I'm trying to make sure that I have a good handle on the scope of the rule that you want us to adopt here. So in that kind of a situation, I'm understanding that that's not this case, would the state be able to assert its inability to retry the defendant? Would that be something the state could assert as part of Latches?
In the case before the court, I don't...
Not in the case before the court.
Oh, you're going outside beyond that.
Yes,
so suppose I filed a post-conviction motion to reopen or to take back his plea and there's no plea transcript?
Yes.
Of course, I would have trouble proceeding then at proving a Bangert error if I can't point to anything in the transcript that was an error.
Well,
but
the argument that we heard just before yours suggests that the transcript does not exist. There's an automatic right to a new trial, right? So in a hypothetical situation in which the transcript does not exist because the defendant waited for 10 years to bring the writ, would the state be able to assert the lack of the transcript, the potential lack of witnesses or faded memories as a reason why he would be unable to retry the person, would that be something they could assert as part of Latches?
In other words, asserting a Latches defense to the post-conviction motion, say, to withdraw a plea? Is that what you're suggesting? I'm really having trouble grasping your
point. Yeah, okay. So let me line it out a little more clearly. Conviction for first-degree homicide, right? Defendant says, I want to do an appeal. The attorney doesn't, and now we are 10 years later. There's no transcript. There are no witnesses. There's no nothing. So we're looking at the writ petition, and we're saying, well, okay, what happens if we grant the writ, right? And we do allow reinstatement of the direct appeal rights. And if we go with the rule that was proposed by the defendant in the case before you, we would then say automatic new trial because there's no transcript. Okay? So my question is, in response to that writ petition, could the state argue, well, look, here's what it's going to look like on retrial. No witnesses, faded memories, all that kind of thing.
Well, that sounds like a claim that could be made any time a client or a defendant asks for a new trial. Years have passed. Witnesses have moved on. Witnesses have disappeared. I don't understand how that, I mean, granted, you might have added years in your scenario, but retrials are always difficult. I've never heard of a situation where the state said, we can't retry this case, so Latches should prevent
a new trial. Right, that's coupled to the unreasonable delay portion, right? So the state would say, well, look, defendant, you waited a really, really long time, and because of that, witnesses are unavailable or memories have faded. That's our prejudice. Because of your unreasonable delay, that's the posture we're now in. Could the state not assert that?
Well, that is asserting Latches. I don't know of a case where you could assert Latches to prevent. I'm not even sure. You're positing this in a posture where appellate rights are already restored. And now this.
I'm positing we're at the writ stage. The defendant is asking for reinstitution of his direct appeal rights, understanding that if he gets them, he gets an automatic new trial. Right? Can the state say, whoa, before you do that, I want you to look at what this is going to look like in that automatic retrial? Can the state do that?
I'm still having trouble grasping where the automatic new trial.
We're well beyond your time limit, so thank you, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did you want to make a sentence to summarize your final position?
Yes, Your Honor. Latches should not prevent Mr. Wren from having his appeal rights reinstated, both because his delay, however long, was not unreasonable given his circumstances, given the failings of his defense counsel to start the appeal and his limitations that prevented him from knowing how to proceed after he realized that happened. And I don't believe either that the state was prejudiced because I don't see what Mr. Kostic could have really added given the findings of fact here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much both for good briefs and a good argument. We are going to take a break now, and we will hear our third case at 1:30. We are adjourned.